Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. And what a beautiful, beautiful day it is today. Do you know that of the 3 million practicing Buddhists in America today, almost 1 million also identify themselves as Jewish? My first guest is joining us to tell how Jewish Dharma can ease loneliness and help us find true support and more. My second guest today wrote a best-selling novel set in the 1920s. Amy Bloom's novel, Away, is based on a true account of a Russian girl who walked from New York to Alaska trying to get home to Russia. And if you're in the need of a shot of capital to take your business to the next level or to get that new idea off the ground, Scott Shane returns to share his expert knowledge about angel investors, what they look like, and where you can find them. You might even want to be an angel investor. First, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Brenda Shoshana. She's been a practicing psychologist for over 25 years and is a long-term Zen practitioner and practicing Jew. She's the author of Zen and the Art of Falling in Love, and her new book is called Jewish Dharma, A Guide to the Practice of Judaism and Zen. Dr. Brenda Shoshana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here with you.
Yeah, very interesting book. What an interesting concept, Judaism and Buddhism together. I want to start off just by sharing a little bit about how you were raised. You were raised in an Orthodox Jewish family.
Yes.
And I know that at some point you became estranged from Judaism. Tell us what happened, what took you away from that, and what led you into Zen practice.
Oh, that's actually an interesting question. Well, the way I became actually introduced to Zen practice was when I was 15 years old. I really wasn't estranged from Judaism then, but I had a teacher in the high school that I went to who gave me a little brown paper bag, and he said, take this home and don't tell anyone and open it up, and there's something in here that's just perfect for you. So, of course, in these days, if anybody gave somebody a bag like that, it would be quite dangerous. But I went home and I opened up the little brown paper bag, and in it was a book called On Zen by D.T. Suzuki. So in those days, of course, Zen was really hush-hush, especially in the neighborhood that I lived in.
Right.
But somehow this teacher saw something, and he knew the book, he knew about it, and he saw something in me. He just felt it would be right, and he was so correct. I mean, I began to read that book, and I just couldn't put it down. In fact, I carried it with me wherever I went for years and years and kept reading it and reading it, until I actually found my teacher and found the Zendo, which is a place where we actually learn how to practice our Zen.
Interesting. Now, how did you then get back hooked into Judaism as well? How did you
start? Well, you know, I had a period where I did actually leave the community and left and actually married someone who wasn't involved at all with the community, and many, many things happened. And so when I began my Zen practice, at that point, I wasn't really practicing Judaism at all at that time. And I was just living close by in Manhattan to the Zendo, to the New York Zendo. And my situation was such I could go every day. It was quite a wonderful time. But believe it or not, it's so interesting. The more I practiced, the more I began to feel my wish to go back to my Jewish practice as well.
Now, tell us why. What was it that you felt maybe was missing for you?
Okay, well, it was not going back instead of, but, you know, as I sat, a lot of the old Jewish prayers began to resurface in my mind, and a lot of the beautiful melodies and the teachings, and it just kept arising in me, and I had a longing to also, to be close to God and to observe many of the traditions, which are very, very beautiful and not in conflict with true Zen practice at all. And I felt somehow that no matter how deep Zen practice was, for me, it was something was missing, mm-hmm. unless I, if I wasn't able to connect to God. Now, I know that's not very popular in the Zen world, but that's how I felt. And, of course, there are many, many Jews who do practice in the Zendos. But for me, both together made me feel complete and whole.
Right, because there are kind of opposing viewpoints there, because I'm not an expert on either one by any means, but as I understand it, in Judaism, you pray to a god.
And right, and it's interesting. And in Zen, some of the Zen teachers or groups say there is no god, there is no soul. But it's really, really important to understand that when you sit a lot, it's not about getting caught in an idea of what is God or a concept of God. It's really when you sit, it's about making everything that happens to you fresh and real and direct and alive so that you experience it directly for yourself.
Okay.
So it's not that when they say there is no God, all they really mean is don't cling to a concept of what God is. Just experience that, the infinite, directly for yourself.
Okay. You say that in the book that, and your book, I should say, the full title here is Jewish Dharma, A Guide to the Practice of Judaism and Zen. And you say that through years of practice as a psychologist, as somebody who practices Judaism, and as a Zen student, you've seen how Zen and Jewish practice hold the keys to understanding the primal questions that drive us. So tell us how they complement one another.
Well, I think they're so very important, actually, because for instance, when one does practice Zazen practice, one becomes very awakened and very focused and very able to concentrate and very sincere and authentic. And so when you do take on the mitzvot, now the mitzvot in Judaism are one of the keystones of Jewish practice. And they are not necessarily good deeds, which people think, but the mitzvot are actions which we take at certain times and which we refrain from doing at other times. And what they really are channels for drawing down blessings and healing energies and drawing forth love into your life.
Mm.
So when you're sitting and you enter a certain state of awakeness and this alertness and connection and concentration, and you have that state of mind, and then you do the mitzvot in that state of mind, it's unbelievable, the power. It's just unbelievable the power these actions have in your life, and they make by sitting, it makes the mitzvot very relevant and very real and almost spontaneous at times and natural. So I think sometimes we can follow a tradition, a Jewish tradition, Christian tradition, any tradition, in a kind of a rote way because we have to,
mm-hmm.
because we have
mm-hmm.
guilt about it, right?
Right.
Because
right.
we're conditioned to do it, but we don't really taste it, the beauty and the value of it for ourselves.
Yeah, customizing it.
Pardon?
Customizing it for yourself.
Well, it's just making it alive and
yeah.
making it real, not doing it in rote, not, sometimes in temples and in churches and all over the world, people can say one thing and then do another, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
we see that a lot, We see that people are, pray, or listen to a teaching on and on, but then you leave and a totally different behavior out in the world. There's kind of a split. But when you sit and you do it, the split begins to really disappear.
I love this, and I want to share this with our listeners. You describe the practice of Judaism and Zen practice as two wings of a bird, and you say in the book, a Jewish heart is warm, devoted to family and friends. A Zen eye is fresh, direct, and spontaneous. These two practices are like two wings of a bird. Both are needed to be able to fly.
Yes, thank you very much. It's so true. I'm smiling as you read it. It's so true because, unfortunately, sometimes in the Zen world or in certain parts of the Zen world, we can become a little disconnected, unfortunately, from our humanity and not being caring enough or not really feeling that devotion to friends and family that makes one's human life whole and complete.
Mm.
And also, I think it's so necessary to maintain our human point of view, the warmth, the caring, the concern for others, the ability to read. Now, that is part of the Zen teaching. Of course, that's the Bodhisattva's vow. But in actual practice, there can be a tendency to become a little more remote from friends and family or to feel that one has everything they need on the cushion. And that's a danger point there.
Okay.
And in Judaism, there's a danger point, too, of being stuck in rules and rituals and doing things out of rote and also feeling somehow that unable to break out of the group and to share this with the whole world. So it's very, very important to be fresh and in the moment and alive, and to know that whoever comes into your life is someone to share everything with. You really learn from Zen practice how to be open in that to all people and to let go of all prejudice. And I feel that is so important.
Right.
And you know, and that's what Jewish teachings are really about. People don't realize it, but
yeah.
True Jewish teachings, they're really about welcoming everybody.
Right. And there are some areas where the two practices really challenge each other. I want to ask how you reconcile that. And the immediate example that springs to mind for me is that Judaism and Buddhism have very opposing views on death and what happens to us afterward. So how do you reconcile
that? Actually, it's interesting, but they don't. Because in Jewish teachings, in the Torah, there's also a very strong belief in the afterlife.
Oh, I did not know that.
Reincarnation. It's called the Gilgal. And there is a strong belief that one comes back many times and you come back to do mitzvot that you didn't do in this life. Very similar to Zen teachings of the wheel of karma and reincarnation afterwards. It's very, very similar, but people don't really understand that. Of course, there is a teaching of the bardo in Zen teachings that after a person leaves, although that's emphasized more in the Tibetan teachings, but that's accepted in the Zen world too. After you leave, you know, there's 49 days in the bardo when there's a process of leaving one aspect of your life and going to another. And also in Judaism, you know, they have that year of transition when the practitioner says the Kaddish, the prayers for the dead. And those prayers are not only for the people here on earth to feel better, but it elevates the soul of one who departed. So you keep your connection with the person who left when you do these prayers every day, and you're helping them on the other side. It's so nice because, you know, one of the great pains when we lose someone, we feel, oh, we can't help them anymore, we're not with them anymore, or maybe somebody died, and we feel, oh, I didn't do enough for them. So when you do say the prayers for the dead, the Kaddish, which are said every day for 1 year, you do feel then that you're still connected and you can help, and they're in turn receiving and giving benefit in return.
Oh, interesting. Now, I want to look at a way that they complement one another. And in the book, you talk about guarding our words. In Buddhism, we often refer to that as right speaking. So
yes.
How do these parallel? How do these complement one another?
Well, these are extremely parallel. You know, there is very, in Judaism, one of the most important mitzvot or teachings or actions of everything is called the teaching about what's called Lashon Hara, which is not to gossip and not to listen to gossip. It says in the Jewish teachings that many of the great catastrophes that happened to the Jewish people came about because of gossip. Isn't that interesting? Because of speaking ill of each other,
right.
and of being deceptive in your speech and of slandering others. So that's hugely important in Jewish practice, just hugely important. Now, in Zen practice as well, right speech is considered one of the bulwarks of Zen practice, which means to guard your words, you know, not to speak ill of others. And actually, doing Zazen itself, the sitting meditation, gives us the strength and power to be able to execute these important teachings. You know, it's sometimes words just pop out, or if we're in a fight, we'll somehow say things we don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
But when you sit a lot, you gain a kind of balance, a profound balance in your life and an ability not to be driven by your impulses, so that you won't, you know, you're able to stop gossiping. You're able not to let these words pop out. And even as you sit more and more, what you do is purify your heart and mind so that the negativity isn't bubbling up as much. It's less and less and less.
Right, right. How does the Jewish concept of karma, which I think you say is a tikkun, how does it differ from Buddhist concept?
Well, you know, it really, I mean, if you're thinking of the concepts of Buddhism, Buddhism doesn't have a concept of the soul per se. And Judaism does. That's a very strong concept. There are three parts of the soul. But a tikkun, actually, in practice, is the same thing as karmic balancing. I mean, a tikkun, when something bad happens to you in this world, they say, well, it was a tikkun, meaning it was a repair for your soul. another way of saying a karmic balancing, meaning you've done something at some point, and this came to you to balance it, to wipe the slate clean, so that if you'd hurt someone, either in this life or at another time, and you receive something negative in your life, what you're taught to say is, may this be a tikkun for me, may this be a cleansing, may it be a karmic balancing, rather than to react with anger in return. So if someone hurts you or insults you, that's all for a purpose. It's because somehow your soul is being purified and cleansed of anything it may have done itself. Mm. It's exactly the same teaching in the Bodhisattva's vow. I mean, it's exactly the same teaching. It says, when someone hurts me, may I, you know, when I bow to him and realize it's the avatar of Buddha coming to give me really a karmic balancing to purify me of deeds that I have done. So it's exactly the same concept in practice. And if you're insulted or harmed by someone, the teaching is not to respond in kind, but to accept it. And if you do, the Torah says your sins are washed away. And in Zen, if you do receive it in a quiet way, again, their purification takes place.
Mm.
Interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. It is interesting, Dr. Brenda. The book is quite fascinating because I knew very little about Judaism and I know a bit more about Zen, but very interesting.
But it must be very different from what you thought of it, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it is actually.
that's another one of the reasons I wanted to write it so badly, because people have no idea what Jewish practice is, and what we see often is unpleasant or we don't really understand it. So I think it's very important to bring out the beauty and the truth of what it really is.
Well, it's such an ancient scripture as well. I mean, it is built around stereotypes, unfortunately, so often. And I think that's why we don't fully understand how beautiful it can be.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about loneliness, because
Yes. You
say blending both practices can help resolve loneliness and help you can help you find true support, which I think today many people, despite all the technology we have to keep us connected, many people actually feel disconnected.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful point. And, you know, they feel more lonely because of the technology, because, you know, we connect in a very weird way. It's almost like fantasy relationships.
Right.
Through the
right.
Email, click, click, click. And we're always connected, but we're always alone, you know. It's through a text message and online, and these fantasy people pop on your screen and pop
right,
off
right,
again.
They do.
And if you don't like someone, you just hit the delete button and they're gone. And of course, this has nothing to do with real relationship and has nothing to do with really being in the presence of one another and of really sharing who you are. So in a sense, you know, in Zazen, when we sit in meditation, I mean, that's such a beautiful, powerful way of connecting to your own deepest self. And yet you're sitting with others, not talking to them, but sitting with them, and you feel their presence so strongly. Of course, all the technological innovations are gone in that case. And you feel a sense of support that goes way beyond any money you have, any accomplishments, any achievements. It's, you feel the support of your own being and of the Zazen practice and of all the people with you. And in Judaism, they say everything difficult that happens to us happens for a purpose, for the reason that we should pray to God and know where our true support comes from. It comes, support is available always, everywhere. So prayer, then there's many, many beautiful ways of praying in Jewish practice, chanting and just talking straight to God under a tree, and many, many, many different forms of prayer, including Zazen. I really view Zazen as a form of prayer. And it even says in the Torah, the old masters of old, they would sit for 1 hour, pray for 1 hour, and then sit for another hour. And they would actually do this 3 times a day. And when somebody said, well, if they did that, how could they have their needs met? And then the answer was, well, if they did that, everything they need just came to them. All the support, all the connection, all the warmth. Really, when you really take a practice deeply, loneliness disappears, because I think that loneliness really is not about being separated from other people, but the terrible separation from ourselves and from God or from the divine, whatever you want to call it, or higher self or Mu. I mean, there are different names for it. We have many different names for it. Nevertheless, there is a larger being, a larger infinite being for us to connect to, and it is within ourselves, and it's also beyond ourselves. And when we connect to that, either through prayer or through Zazen or through study, I mean, there are many ways, then loneliness really evaporates. It just disappears.
Mm, interesting. Now, tell us how the Sabbath works into the blend of East and West.
Well, you know, Zazen is about non-doing, stopping, right? We stop running around. We stop chasing after things. We give up control and we sit. We just sit. And there we are. And we are able then to experience our oneness with life. And we also give up a lot of our cravings and our attachments. Now, in the Sabbath, you do the same thing, really. You one day a week for 24 hours, it's a strong practice. You just let go. You don't shop. You don't answer the phone. You don't watch TV. You don't cook. You let go of your control of the material world. It's a day of prayer. It's a day of singing. It's a day of eating wonderful meals with people in your community. It's not about being alone.
Mm-hmm.
It's about
mm-hmm.
being together. But it's a day when you have to see who really does control this universe. And it's a day of saying thank you for all the beautiful gifts that you've received all week long, which we usually don't even notice. So both Zazen, you know, which stills us so much and helps us let go on one way, and then in the Sabbath, just letting go of all the things that we've clung to all week. It's a beautiful way of learning how not to be so attached to the physical world, and also to be closer to people that we're dear to. And also the most important part is, of course, to know, as they say, who runs the world, who's in charge, where all the gifts, where the food comes from, where the love between you and your family and your friends comes from. It's a day to stop and really take note and to say thank you.
Sounds good to me. And I think that's a great note to end our segment on. I thank you so much for being with us. And I want you to give out your website, Dr. Brenda.
Okay, well, the website for the book is www.JewishDharma.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brenda Shoshana.
Thank you for having me.
And her book, again, A Guide to the Practice of Judaism and Zen, Jewish Dharma. And please stay with us. We'll be right back with Amy Bloom, novelist Amy Bloom.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Does the rat race get you down?
Would you like to opt out or shake things up? Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on the third Monday of every month to hear about alternative lifestyles and viable career options. Coming November 17th, learn what it takes to build a profitable freelance lifestyle with longtime freelancer Michelle Goodman. Hear about the ups and downs, how you can create your own work hours, how to build a solid reputation, and what you should consider before quitting your day job. Michelle Goodman is a Seattle-based expert who's learned firsthand how to support herself while building a successful freelance business. Join us for Get a Freelance Life, coming Monday, November 17th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
At work, I just take time, and all through my coffee break time.
Welcome back. We are talking in this section with Amy Bloom. She's a novelist. She wrote the book Away. And this is her second novel, I believe. It's being called the biggest literary hit of the year. It received rave reviews in the New York Times, the LA Times Book Review, Entertainment Weekly, the Washington Post Book World, and the list goes on. Amy has also written two collections of short stories and is a nominee for the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her stories have appeared in Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Awards, and numerous anthologies here and abroad. And she's also written for many magazines, including New Yorker, the New York Times Magazine, and Atlantic Monthly. She lives in Connecticut and teaches at Yale University. Amy Bloom, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Well, I was telling you during the short commercial that we just took that I don't read fiction very often. I just have a really hard time getting into fiction books. And this drew me straight in. And I'm sure you've been told that a lot because you create such a great sense of atmosphere, such a great sense of place.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, the truth is that the 1920s were interesting to me for a lot of reasons, but partially because they really are the modern world. I never felt like I was writing a historical novel. I just felt that I was writing a novel set in a town I had never been in, which was the 1920s. And, you know, it was a very fast-moving, very sexy, very political, very divided time. And it wasn't like writing about 15th century Venice, where you sort of have to concentrate on every button and wooden shoe. These were modern
right.
people.
Right. Now, I want to ask you about this, because I read in one spot that this was based on a true story. I also read in an interview where you said, well...
Well, that is what I say. I say, well... I think it's a little more like the alligators in the sewers of New York. You know, everybody loves the story. No one has actually seen one.
Mm.
Everybody always liked the idea of this woman who tried to walk to Russia from the, you know, essentially from the Northwest. But when you get up to Alaska, which has a wonderful public library system and a wonderful set of research archives, you start looking in the articles and you realize, well, there are two things. And I have to say, I'm the daughter of two journalists, so I did notice that although the headline said, woman walks plans to walk to Russia, the next sentence would say, although she doesn't speak English. I would say, I wonder how they knew she planned to walk to Russia. And so it seems to me it was a story that every journalist in the 1920s picked up, but there isn't any evidence that she really existed.
Right. And now the claim was the claim that she walked from New York to Alaska?
Yes. The claim was that she somehow managed to get from New York to the West Coast. And that was one of the first things that was interesting to me because, again, one of the ways in which this was the modern world is that I thought, gosh, how could you possibly get from New York to the West Coast? Now, wouldn't it take you a month even by train? And, of course, it took you like 3 days by train.
Right.
You know, New York to Chicago is 20 hours.
Right, right.
And so that gave me an opportunity to write a very different kind of book that was not just about a sort of one foot in front of the other hiking adventure, but sort of about movement through an entire country and continent.
So how did you come across this story, the supposed true story, and then what went on in your mind, and how did that suddenly transpire into a novel?
Well, the kernel of the story, I have to give credit to my dad, who was a newspaper reporter and then a magazine writer, and he loved the odd fact. I mean, I'd be doing my homework, and he'd say things like, you know, honey, there are only 6 blacksmiths still practicing in Illinois. And I'd say, well, no, Daddy, I didn't know that. And really, one day he said to me, you know, there's that story about that woman who walked to Russia. What a nut she must have been. I was about 11, and it did really stay with me. And I did think, well, if you weren't a nut, and you weren't doing it for power or money or property,
mm-hmm.
then truly the only reason you do it is for love. And that did stay with me and sort of popped up again about 45 years later.
Mm. So how much time did you spend on doing the research for the historical background? Because you were very authentic to the time and the situation that immigrants went through.
Well, the research was a great pleasure. And the fact is that once you're in sort of the Western world with people who can write, there are a tremendous number of first-person accounts. People publish their diaries and their journals, or they deposit them with various libraries. And if you're willing to make the trip to the library, I mean, for me as a writer, it's like being allowed into the vault of Tiffany's. You know, everything is beautiful and interesting. And then my job is to pick the stuff that helps the story move along, not just the stuff that interesting and catches my eye. But there were a lot of first-person accounts of immigrants, not just of Jewish immigrants, but of all the different immigrants that came to America through Ellis Island between, you know, let's say 1860 and 1920, which was the period I was interested in.
Mm. Now, she was a Jewish immigrant, your protagonist.
Yes.
What did you learn about immigrants in that time, and how do you think perceptions really, or perspectives of immigrants, has changed over the years?
I don't know that they have changed that much. I think we're more polite than we used to be. We don't post signs as we did in America, you know, 150 years ago that says no dogs, no Irish.
Mm.
You know, we don't have separate water fountains anymore. We don't have the same kind of quota system, so we're certainly better behaved than we were. But the fact is, we're here, and immigrants come from somewhere else, and it's hard to get used to somebody who doesn't speak the language the way you do, and who doesn't look the way you do, and whose habits are not the same. And, you know, there was tremendous, you know, disdain for Jewish immigrants, just as there always are for immigrants. You know, people would come down from the Upper East Side of New York to the Lower East Side with pamphlets and bars of soap.
Oh, really?
And, you know, some of those impulses are no different. It's always easy to feel superior to somebody who is new to the place.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about your story. I don't want to do that because I don't want to risk giving away any spoilers, but...
Well, I can talk about the beginning, I think,
mm-hmm.
and there won't be any spoilers. You know, Lillian is a young woman in her early 20s. She is married. She has a baby. She lives with her parents in a small village in Russia, in the part of Russia that so many Eastern European immigrants came from. And there's a pogrom in her town. And the truth is the pogroms were not always organized by the government. Sometimes they were just organized by your neighbors who were having a very bad year and needed somebody to blame for a crop failure or the death of some cattle. And her family is slaughtered, and having nothing left and no one left, she comes to America and begins to settle in, working for the Yiddish theater as a seamstress, and discovers that when one of her cousins comes from her village and says to her, "I know you think your daughter Sophie is dead, but she's not. She's alive in Russia." And Lillian discovers that she must return to Russia.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite character in the book? Your characters are very rich, and some I liked a little less than others. Do you have a favorite, and do you have a least favorite, and why?
Well, they are not all likable. I mean, I think the truth is you have to write characters that you love, but you don't always like them, and you certainly don't like everything they do.
But that's what makes it so real.
I think so. I also always feel that, you know, good people doing good things doesn't make for much of a book. I think that, I mean, Lillian really has my heart in many ways because she is so stubborn, even when she knows that she's being foolish, and I'm very sympathetic to that. I think I have a real affection for Gumdrop Brown, who's the prostitute in Seattle who takes her in just because she, like Lillian, is determined. And I like that. But I have soft spots for all of them. I don't think you can really write a character that you don't love.
I think not, no. You develop a great sense of place, as I said. You're instantly drawn into that beginning. You can almost smell the streets of New York. Language also plays a very prevalent part in the book, doesn't it?
It does.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think I've always been fascinated by language. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the public library when I was a little girl, and my parents were good enough to never censor what I read. And so I think, you know, I had the words that I could read, but I couldn't pronounce, that I was a little afraid to bring out in front of other people, but I was so fascinated by the words. And I had always thought that the way we appear in another language is so different than the way we know ourselves to be. I know that who I am in Italian is a kind of good-natured 10-year-old. You know, I'm not myself. There are lots of things I can't do in Italian that I can do in English.
Right.
And
right.
So I was just interested in that problem, sort of trying to translate your personality into another language, and the way in which language is kind of this rope that you climb into another place or another country or another class. And so the dictionary and the thesaurus were a big part of that. And those were two books that I loved when I was a kid. I always found them sort of fascinating that you could turn a page and find something you'd never heard of before.
Mm. Now, I want to just quote this. I read that you said about writing, when somebody asked you about the writing process, you said, "I will say that I do get crabby when I go a few days without writing. I can't say that it's some sort of mystical experience for me." So how did you go from being a psychotherapist to, I believe you teach creative writing at Yale right now, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah. How did you go from that to writing books and teaching?
Well, I kept my practice as a therapist for a very long time while I wrote, you know, and I would write at night when my kids were in bed. And they were not incompatible. They were sort of a tiring combination, but they weren't completely incompatible. But as the writing got more successful and I had to be gone more and travel more, I didn't feel that I could do as good a job as a therapist as I like to be able to. And so I allowed my practice to get smaller and smaller and then sort of closed the doors about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was sort of an unexpected transition. I had not grown up wanting to be a writer or anticipating being a writer. I think if you asked me what I wanted to be, I would have said, "I want to be a reader." You know?
Wouldn't it be great to get paid for that?
Right, have that as my full-time job. And it's still true when I do readings, even now, you know, my impulse is to actually sort of, you know, help the sales clerks and say to people, "Well, if you like this, how about this?"
Now, you teach, as I said, at Yale in the creative writing department. Do you believe that writers are born or that they're made?
I think they're mostly born, but you can teach a good writer a lot of things. You cannot teach someone talent.
Mm.
So, you know, you get somebody who comes along who really has an ear for dialogue and a grasp for character and who can see beyond their own shape. That's a real opportunity for teaching. But you cannot make somebody a good writer when they don't have any talent. It's like singing or anything else.
Yeah.
You can't just follow the shape of it. You actually have to have at least a little nugget of ability.
Yeah. Well, Amy, you are now at the top of my list of writers, as good writers. This was an excellent book, and I really thank you for being with us today. Let me give out your website. It's amybloom.com, is that correct?
It is.
Yeah, amybloom.com, and you can find out more about Amy there. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My guest, Amy Bloom, her novel, Away. And again, you can find her at amybloom.com. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking about Fool's Gold, the truth behind angel investing in America today. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for new fiction authors? For a different kind of book? For good writing that challenges the mind, the heart, the spirit? Then check out Book Talk Podcasting at 1150kknw.com. Book Talk brings you weekly bite-sized book reviews brought to you by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. You can listen to Book Talk Podcasts at 1150kknw.com or anytime by downloading them to your MP3 player. If you'd like to try your hand at submitting a review, email info@conversationslive.net for more information. To listen to Book Talk, go to 1150kknw.com and click on podcasting. It's that simple.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit PAWS.org or 425-787-2500. PAWS.org or 425-787-2500.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's The Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss The Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't you know I'm in heaven?
Welcome back. We are talking in this segment to Scott Shane. He's the author of Fool's Gold, The Truth Behind Angel Investing in America. And Scott himself is an angel investor with a North Coast Angel Fund and a professor of entrepreneurship at Case Western Reserve University. He's also the author of Illusions of Entrepreneurship, and he joined us earlier this year to talk about that. And today we're talking about angel investing. Scott Shane, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I wanted to just start off, Scott, by the whole purpose of your book is to expose some of the myths and the truths about angel investing, because a lot of people have a perception of angel investors, and you say that that's not necessarily true. So let's start off with a little bit about what angel investing is, first of all.
Well, an angel investor is any person who takes some of their own money and provides it to a private business that somebody else owns and operates, as long as that other person is neither a friend or a family member. That's basically what makes somebody an angel investor.
And what do they typically look like? Tell us, the profile of an angel investor.
Well, here's where the perception is different from the reality. So our perception, and, this is probably true for your audience where you are, which is somebody who has made a lot of money as an entrepreneur and is putting it back into some technology company that's going to have a high growth trajectory. That's kind of the myth that we have. The reality is that angel investors are much more run-of-the-mill. They really actually are no more likely to have started their own businesses than other people. They are generally not particularly wealthy. They aren't necessarily looking for high-tech businesses to invest in. They're just investing in somebody else's business, and in fact look a lot more like friends and family than we generally think.
Where does most money come from when people are financing their business?
Well, most of the money comes from the entrepreneur themselves or their friends and family. Only about 8% of the informal investment, that is the friends, families, and angels together, are the angels. So most of it's people's friends, their family, and their own money.
So a lot of it is, you wouldn't want to invest informally, I guess. You'd have some kind of contract. But it's not going out to external parties. It's people around us that we look to.
That's right. And actually, the fact is that informal investing is pretty informal. In a lot of cases, people don't have a formal contract. There are a lot of handshake deals that are done. And even when there are contracts, they're very simple without the kinds of provisions that might protect the investor to a large extent in a more formal investment.
Hmm. Now, if I have a small business or I have an idea I want to get off the ground, and I know that you yourself are an angel investor, what are some of the typical questions that an angel investor would ask somebody when they're looking? I was surprised to read in the book that you said some don't even want to see a business plan.
Well, here's the difference between the kind of typical angel and what they're doing and what the angels who are trying to make money on their investments are doing, because that's actually some of the distinction. So the typical person actually do look for a business plan, but about a quarter or so don't actually look for a business plan. They're not, the typical angel isn't really looking for particularly high returns. But people who are trying to make money at this activity, and that's usually people who are part of these angel groups, are looking for high growth companies. They're looking for companies in which you can make an equity investment and you can be protected. Usually you don't want to invest in the kind of business where the entire set of assets that the business has is wrapped up in the entrepreneur and the skills that that person has, because then the assets all go home at night and might not come back the next day.
So in that case, you're talking services. Is that right?
I'm sorry?
In that case, are you talking services? If it's wrapped up in the entrepreneur and the skills they have, you're talking basic services?
A lot of services, right? So a good example of that might be some kind of novel medical operation where it's all wrapped up in the talent of the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what else do they look for?
Well, the successful angels are looking for what are venture capitalists going to invest in, because the venture capitalists are going to, if the investment's going to be successful, are going to invest after the angels. So that means focused on industries like software and the internet, biotechnology and medical devices, the places where the venture capitalists tend to put their money, and they're looking for very high return on their money because it's so risky. And a lot of the businesses fail, the kind of top angels in these groups are looking to get a 30 times return on their money. That is, for every $1,000 that they put in, they're looking to get $30,000 back. Now, that's because the vast majority of the efforts are going to fail, and the way that you make money is off of the one that's successful.
Mm-hmm. So typically, does an angel investor go out looking for businesses to invest in? Do they sit and wait for other people to contact them? How does that work?
Well, in general, you could see some angels that are looking around for deals. Mostly what they're trying to do is let people in the community know that they're interested so that they don't get flooded with a bunch of business opportunities that they would never fund, but at the same time get a flow of deals coming in. Most of this is through networking, through the angels' friends, through service providers like accountants and lawyers providing referrals. The groups, however, these days often have a formal process where people can just send in their business plan through the internet and then have an initial screening done that way.
Mm-hmm. So let's break it down to bare bones, Scott. If I want to find an angel investor, what's the first step I should take?
Well, I think the first thing is try to figure out where the angels are, who they are in your area. About 75% of angel investments are made within 50 miles of where the investor's located.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
Basically, you know, if you're in Seattle, you got to find an investor out there.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be any good because there's no way for me to make that kind of investment at a distance. The Angel Capital Association is an association of angel groups, and one can actually go to the Angel Capital Association's website and find a list of angel groups and where they're located. And that's a good start because the groups tend to be some of the more successful investors. Also talking to lawyers who deal with a lot of startups, talking to accountants that deal with a lot of startups, trying to find people that you know that know angel investors to get some sort of introduction. All of those things are valuable activities.
Okay. Now let's look at the flip side of things. Let's say that I wanted to invest in a business and I wanted to be an angel investor myself. How do I get started in that? You actually have a list of five most common, easy-to-fix mistakes that angels make. I wonder if we could maybe look at those.
Right. Well, getting started isn't very difficult. I mean, you take out your checkbook and you can write a check, and now you're an angel investor. And this is why it's important to be careful about how to do this, because one can immediately become an angel investor and then just lose money. One of the things that's important for angels to do is pay attention to things like the industry in which the companies are coming from. Are they coming from industries where people really can make a lot of money with a company that's growing? Because if you can't make money in the industry in general by investing in someone else's company, you're probably not going to make it in your specific case. Another is to kind of carefully look at the business opportunity. One of the things that's surprising about the typical angel is that the typical angel has a pretty low return expectation and doesn't look very carefully and doesn't do very much due diligence. And that's something that a person can correct themselves by putting more effort into the process.
How do I know if I want to be an angel investor? Should that go through an attorney? I mean, it seems to me kind of risky just to go out and write a check for someone and hope everything's okay.
Well, the first thing that probably want to ask yourself about being an angel investor is, do you want something else from being involved with financing startups other than just making money? Because it's not the best way to try to make money. It's very risky. To be successful, you have to make a fair number of investments. Making a fair number of investments takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and most angels just make too few and are undiversified. So the first thing is, why are you doing it? If you're doing it to both make money and because you like working with entrepreneurs and startups, that's a better reason than just trying to make money.
Okay.
I think another thing that's useful is if people are the kinds of accredited investors, the higher net worth individuals that can join angel groups, that's a better way to do it than trying to do this on your own. You get the assistance of working with other people. Plus, it's a lot easier to diversify and invest in a lot of startups when you're putting your money in as part of a larger group than trying to individually invest in companies. And of course, like anything, if you're going to write a contract and work with anybody to make an investment, you should probably work with an attorney to create a good contract.
Mm. Tell us what happens to most angel-backed companies. How many get acquired? How many go into the IPO process?
So this is an interesting statistic that I found in the process of doing the research, which is that very few angel-backed companies have these kinds of exits that we're hoping for. Less than 0.3% of angel-backed companies go public, and only a couple percent get acquired. So when we try to think about this, it's not 1 in 10 companies that's going to get the exit. It's more along the lines of maybe 3 or so companies out of 100 where you're going to get that kind of outcome. So either you need to be a really good angel and be the ones that get maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 odds while other people are essentially getting zero outcome, or you need to be very diversified and making a lot of investments so that you can make sure you cover at least one winner.
Mm. Is there a minimum amount that an angel investor will contribute or an average amount?
Well, this is an interesting thing that came out in the process of looking at this. The average amount that an angel investor puts into a startup is actually fairly large. It's $77,000.
Wow.
But the median or typical amount is not that large at all. It's only $10,000, which means that there's a lot of people out there that are making fairly small angel investments. Either they're investing as part of a group, a small amount, or the businesses that they're investing in are taking smaller chunks of money. And then there's a few people who are making these very large investments, probably in the most high potential companies.
Well, good information, Scott. I want to thank you for joining us today. You don't have a website, do you? It's very long, actually. Is there a quicker way to find you on the web?
Yes. Well, the best way to find me is to actually just Google Scott Shane at Case Western Reserve University, and that's the best way to find me.
Okay. I thank you so much for being with us today, Scott.
Thank you.
My guest, Scott A. Shane, his book, Fool's Gold, The Truth Behind Angel Investing in America. And coming up on, let's see, when is she coming? December 1st, where we have novelist Catherine Neville joining us. But I wanted to let you know that she's going to be here in Seattle on November 12th, which is, this coming Wednesday? She'll be at Third Place Books at, let me tell you right, at 7 o'clock. That's Catherine Neville. And she's the author of the best-selling Author of the Eight, and her new book is called The Fire. So I want to wish my comrade here, Eric Ryder, a very happy birthday. He has a birthday week this week coming up. What are you going to do, buddy? Get on that mic there and tell us how you're going to let loose.
Oh boy, I had what the assisted suicide bill passed in Washington, didn't it? So
okay,
no, okay. I'm just kidding. I don't know yet. I'll have to figure it out. I guess I'm planning on being spontaneous.
Spontaneous. Okay. Well, we wish you all the very best, and I certainly appreciate everything you do for us at Conversations Live, and it's been
thank you very much.
Wonderful working with Eric the last 4 years. He's a good guy. He's gone all red. So go ahead.
No, that's it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm done. I want to thank each of you for joining us today. I appreciate you two listening in, and we will be back next week with all new programming, so please join us then. Until then, live well, live strong, and thanks for being with us this hour on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Does the rat race get you down?
Would you like to opt out or shake things up? Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair on the third Monday of every month to hear about alternative lifestyles and viable career options. Coming November 17th, learn what it takes to build a profitable freelance lifestyle with longtime freelancer Michelle Goodman. Hear about the ups and downs, how you can create your own work hours, how to build a solid reputation, and what you should consider before quitting your day job. Michelle Goodman is a Seattle-based expert who's learned firsthand how to support herself while building a successful freelance business. Join us for Get a Freelance Life, coming Monday, November 17th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.